Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear arguments from petitioner in Transamerica National Gas versus Rodriguez.
May it please the court, Ms. Mason and Mr. Stokes will present arguments to petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this case is an appeal from a summary judgment in which the trial court correctly held that respondent's claims for the wrongful death of her alleged common law husband were barred by the 1-year statute of limitations provided by Section 1.91B of the Texas Family Code. The trial court correctly understood that Section 1.91 expressly applies to, quote, any judicial, administrative, or other proceeding, end quote, in which a party seeks to prove a common law marriage, and that respondent suit under the Wrongful Death Act and under the Workers' Compensation Act for gross negligence against Julia Fuentes' employer was such a proceeding, since respondent had to prove her marital status in order to show her standing to sue. The San Antonio Court of Appeals erroneously reversed and remanded the summary judgment, simply refusing to apply Section 1.91B to respondent's claim, in spite of the statute's acknowledged plain language. The court's sole basis for disregarding this clear statutory language was a perceived conflict between Section 1.91B and the 2-year statute of limitations provided by Section 16.003B of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Petitioners submit that there is no direct conflict between these statutes and that any alleged incidental conflict does not justify judicial disregard of the explicit statutory directive contained in Section 1.91B.
Should we look to the legislative debates to determine the legislature's intent? The argument's been made that it only applies to divorce cases, and that's all they were thinking about. They didn't intend to defeat wrongful death lawsuits.
Well, Justice Cornyn, I think that when the statute is unambiguous and clear, as in this case, we don't need to look behind the statute to the legislative intent, because the court could have used, as Justice Baker pointed out, the court could have used more explicit language to limit it to the family code or to divorce or other types of proceedings, and they didn't. And I also think that one thing we need to take into account is that at the time they amended Section 1.91B to provide this limitation period in 1989, courts had been applying Section 1.91, the criteria for establishing a common law marriage, to all sorts of proceedings, including wrongful death. The San Antonio Court of Appeals had actually applied Section 1.91A to prove a common law marriage in a wrongful death case in 1985, and there were other cases out there at the time they amended the statute. So I think that given the authority existing at the time of its amendment, the legislature's deliberate decision to use such broad language should not be ignored or arbitrarily limited in its scope.
Let me ask you a question that occurred to me, Ms. Stokes. If this is not a statute of limitations with regard to attempting to establish the marriage, but simply is a, that you can at no time after 1 year, after your spouse has died, can you ever establish that you're married? Could the state after a year of the death, where there's no question about common law marriage, the spouse dies, the property transfers to the spouse, could the state come in and seek to achieve the assets of the estate after that 1 year expires, and the spouse who received the property be unable to establish the common law marriage as a matter of law? I mean, doesn't that pose a bit of a problem?
Well, I don't think it poses a problem in the sense that the legislature has made a policy decision that they don't want these claims coming up after a year, and if the alleged spouse tried to intervene and assert a right to the property, I think the legislature said, we don't want to hear that claim. If we're going to let you have a claim, you've got to press it quickly.
Well, I guess I wasn't thinking in terms of any claims by the spouse. There is, among the family members, there's no dispute, and the property passes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm just talking about where some person comes independent of that, like the state, that could claim the assets because it's not claimed by anybody else with the authority to claim it.
I see.
But this occurs a year after the death, and so the state really initiates a proceeding to claim the assets of the living spouse and interposes 1.91 saying this spouse can never prove her right because a year has passed, she didn't establish by a proceeding
mm-hmm.
that she was the wife And so, as a matter of law, we get the assets.
You're saying in a situation where the family members have agreed among themselves what to do with the property, so no one's ever gone to court?
Right.
Well, I don't know the exact answer to that question. It's a possibility. I think that a common law spouse could avoid that effect easily by applying for an affidavit of heirship or filing a kind of a pro forma proceeding in probate court to say this is what we're going to do with the estate. And I don't think that's an onerous burden in order to satisfy the state's interest in improving that.
But under your view of the statute, it would be advisable for spouses to do that, even though the probate code would not otherwise require it.
Yes, sir. I think that the plain language of Section 1.91B could result in that.
Why was it inappropriate to apply the requirements of the family code in Garza, but not in this case?
Well, Justice Heck, in Garza, they didn't have the family code provisions they were dealing with didn't have any indication that they were meant to apply to any proceeding, and I know this court in Garza specifically said we're not going to apply the legitimation provisions to the Wrongful Death Act absent a legislative indication that we should do so. And I think that Section 1.91, on the other hand, does have such an indication of legislature's intent that it applies. I also think that Garza involved the right of illegitimate children to sue for wrongful death, and as the United States Supreme Court has held, that they're subject to a heightened constitutional scrutiny, and that the state may not deny the right of illegitimate children to sue for wrongful death while at the same time granting it to legitimate children. So incorporating the family and probate code's definition of a child, which at that time excluded unrecognized illegitimate children, might have had that constitutionally prohibited effect.
And you don't think there would be the same problem with common law spouses?
Well, I don't think they're a constitutionally protected class in the sense that illegitimate children are.
Why not?
Well, I think that illegitimacy for children it's not quite the same as race or immutable characteristics in that sense, but you were born and you're illegitimate and you had nothing to do with it. Whereas a common law spouse, marriage is a legal institution, and you can make a decision to enter into it by formal marriage, or you can make a decision to not to do so and to have an informal marriage and follow the requirements for establishing one. I'd like to point out that there's not a direct conflict between these two statutes because they do govern two distinct issues and claims, although they're both involved in this suit. Proof of a common law marriage and proof of negligence resulting in death involve wholly distinct sets of facts. And so I think it was the legislature's prerogative to determine two different time periods for proof of each of these sets of facts in order to protect a defendant against having to defend either of these claims when witnesses were not available or the evidence not fresh. I think in this case, the wisdom of the legislature's determination of a one-year statute of limitations is demonstrated since within a year of Julio Fuentes' death, respondent issued a written statement at the behest of Julio's mother denying the existence of any marital relationship, and yet 2 years later changed her mind well after Julio's parents had filed their own wrongful death and survival claim and after they applied for an administration of his estate. And arguably, this is one of the very types of situations that the legislature was trying to get at when it said we want timely proof of common law marriage. I also think that the statutes in this case serve similar goals. As this court stated in Moreno, one of the purposes of Section 16.003B is the prompt resolution of the decedent's affairs. Section 1.91B effectuates the same state interest by requiring the prompt processing of the claims of a common law marriage to a decedent. But even assuming that they do conflict, I don't think there's anything in the language or history of Section 16.003B that suggests it must prevail Section 16.03B neither creates the right to bring a wrongful death, nor reflects an intent to enlarge the time period for bringing such a claim, such that it would preclude the application of any shorter statute of limitations.
There is a declaratory judgment action. Who is served? A woman goes into court and pleads that she's the common law wife of the deceased, states under oath the elements that are required, and is that then res judicata?
Well, I think she could serve the estate, since if the decedent had been living, she would have served him. She could serve the estate, or in this case, the parents, since they claim to be heirs, and indeed the father was the administrator. I think...
Is that required? I mean, I'm curious if it's going to then allow her to bring any number of actions as the widow.
Well, Your Honor, I understand the seeming problem, although she could file an application for heirship or to be an administrator and then go forth and sue on the basis of those judgments in those cases.
But is that her only option, to file in the probate court?
To either file some type of probate proceeding or declaratory judgment in district court or to...
That's my problem. If it's a declaratory action, it sounds to me like it's an ex parte kind of proceeding. She can swear that she's the common law wife, and that ends the matter.
Well, as I said, I think she should. If I were she, I would serve the estate, and then once
that... Is there any requirement under proving up a common law marriage that you have to... all of those people would be necessary parties?
No, not that I know of, Your Honor. The only real declaratory judgment under 1.91 that I found is that Georgiada's case, and that was where the alleged husband was still living. So I just haven't found any cases that address what would happen.
When one of the spouses is deceased, it really is impractical, isn't it, to have one party go in and prove up a common law marriage that becomes racist?
Well, I don't know if it's impractical. I mean, it's unusual in the sense that it would probably, it might be a case of first impression until she got to the wrongful death stage. I wanted to point out that unlike the statute involved in Shepherd versus Leopard, the first case this court heard today, Section 16.03B does not contain any language which even remotely indicates an intent to preclude the application of all other limitations period. We do not have any language such as notwithstanding the law, any other law, that this court discussed in the Bala case said reflected an intent to preclude any other limitations period that might conflict with it. Rather, I think the conflict perceived by the Court of Appeals results from the mere fact that Section 1.91B has a one-year statute of limitations and Section 16.03 has a two-year statute of limitations. But if such a conflict is sufficient to justify a complete disregard of Section 1.91B's express terms, it is difficult to see how Section 1.91B could be applied to any type of proceeding. Common law marriage is usually not a standalone claim, but necessarily is brought in some type of proceeding, and almost all proceedings have their own statute of limitations. And under the Court of Appeals reasoning, if the underlying statute of limitations is not also 1 year from death, Section 1.91B would conflict and couldn't be applied. Moreover, I discussed that point already. I think also the legislature has indicated its intent that if these two code provisions do conflict, the latest in date of enactment shall prevail. In Section 311.025A of the Government Code, known as the Code Construction Act, the legislature states that, quote, if two statutes enacted at the same or different sessions of the legislature are irreconcilable, the statute latest in date of enactment prevails. And since Section 1.91B was amended in 1989 to provide this limitations period, and Section 16.003B was codified in 1985, I believe that Section 1.91B would survive any conflict. To conclude, I know that the Court of Appeals discussion of a conflict was influenced by a perception that it would be unfair to apply the limitations period to, quote, benefit a tortfeasor. We've already discussed why I believe that the cases they rely upon for this provision, Garza and Brown, are in a, the reasoning in those cases is inapplicable. I also believe that preclusion of the legal remedy alone is and a legal remedy that does not constitute a fundamental right, as the court has said in Rose versus Doctors Hospital, would not justify an exception to the limitations period.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Alicia Cindy Richter will present argument to the
May I please report? Petitioner is erroneous in asserting that there is no conflict between Section 1.91B and Section 16.03 of the Wrongful Death Act. Specifically, let's take a look at the actual language of both of these statutes. And I'm going to turn to 1.91A and B originally. Okay, if, as enacted in 1989, Section A says, in any judicial, administrative, or other proceeding, and proceeds on to say that you can prove common law marriage either by a judicial declaration of, by both parties where they execute and file it at the courthouse, or you have the three elements of agreement, pulling out, and cohabitation.
That's passed 69, right?
69. Yes, sir. But what I'm looking at is the effect of the 1989 amendment as it works with the entire 1.91. And thereafter, it changes the inference that was in Section B to a completely different thing, saying a proceeding in which a marriage is to be proved must be commenced on must be commenced before or not later than 1 year from the date the relationship ended. What happens when they changed it in 1989 is Section B applies to both A1 and A2. So even if you have consent by both of the parties in Section A1, you still have to file an action to establish the marriage within 1 year after a death or a separation. Okay. In Section 6.003B, we have the language, a person must bring an action or a suit not later than 2 years after the day the cause of action accrued in an action for injury resulting in death. So we have a statement here where it says we have a conflict between Section B under 1.91, which is a proceeding in which a marriage is to be proved under this section, and we have a statement where it says a person.
You don't have a conflict if you can bring separate proceedings.
But I don't believe that that's what the effect of 9.19, okay, of Section B is. The effect of Section B is requiring an action in which a marriage has to be established, has to be brought within 1 year. And that's what...
You can bring that action, and then a year later you can bring the wrong message.
But there is a conflict, because it's, what's happening here is that as was in the Shepherd case ahead of us, they're saying, no, you have to bring the one action before you can bring the other. And in this, and how do I say
that? So why is that a conflict?
Why is it a conflict? Because that's not the language of the statute. Statute says you have to bring an action in which a marriage is to be proved must be commenced. It says an action. That means an action where you have the wrongful death case in this action, or you have some other tort case. It doesn't say you have 1 year to establish your marriage, and then you can file any other action thereafter.
But if you prove it in the first case, isn't that proved as to the second one or not?
Well, yes, I guess you would, but it,
Couldn't a common law spouse, excuse me, seek to be appointed the personal representative of the estate of her deceased common law spouse and thereby, in the course of that probate proceeding, establish the existence of a common law marriage within a year of the death? Would that be one alternative means by which the status as common law husband and wife could be established within a year of the end of the relationship?
Are you saying that if a person brings...
If I died today, okay, could my wife go to court tomorrow, assuming we were common law husband and wife, and ask the probate judge to appoint her as the personal administrator of my estate, assuming that I was intestate, and thereby seek to qualify as my common law wife, and thereby establish the relationship under the terms of Section 1.91. Is that one alternative, is all I'm asking?
Yes.
Okay.
In the second argument brought forth, petitioner asserts that that these laws don't serve similar goals, or that they do serve similar goals, but I assert that they don't, because if such were true, then Section A1, as it applies to Section B, they'd also have to still bring an action to establish their marriage, even though they already had a consensual statement which said that they were common law married on file.
You do agree that for purposes of the survival statute and the wrongful death statute, that only a surviving spouse under the wrongful death statute under the wrongful death statute and a heir under the survival statute, those are the only ways that a common law spouse could be entitled to assert those actions. Do you agree with that?
Not necessarily, because the issue that we have, the actual statute that we have in front of us is the statement that says a person. Arguably, perhaps you might say that if the say it's the wife, the surviving spouse, can bring it as a surviving spouse or as an heir, if you're applying another section, yes. But the way, the issue that has come and the way I understand it is that 16003 is what is conflicting with 1.91 in the terms that they're trying to say that that the common law spouse is not in person under 16.03, that she has to jump through the hoop to establish that she's common law married before she can even bring the that she has standing to bring it as a person.
But that's true. I mean, you're going to have to prove it somewhere. She's a common law spouse.
Well,
either in the wrongful death action or ahead of time or something.
True. But I think what's been used, what's happened in this case and what I think is happening in the Shepherd case that you've just heard is that they're using it as a statute of limitations. And that's what it is. It's operating as a statute of limitations. If you don't bring a case in which you're seeking to establish your common law relationship in addition to your wrongful death action within the 1 year period, you've been precluded from doing that.
What about as between two claimants to a common law marriage? What if there were two persons who claimed that they were the common law spouse of the deceased? Shouldn't the one that tries to comply with the family code be in a better position than the one that doesn't comply?
I don't know. You would have to have an evidentiary hearing, I guess, to establish who has better rights. I think maybe it would pertain to I guess if you have two people competing for the same, and they both have claims.
Well, they can't both have claims.
They can't both have, well, both assert a claim. You have an action to establish only the existence of a common law marriage. You wouldn't have an additional claim going forward from there. What essentially is happening with the operation of Section B is that, say you did have two people who were asserting claims of common law marriage, if they didn't bring it within the 1 year statute of limitations under B, they wouldn't have any claim at all. And the effect of this statute is to divest people of a property interest, whether it's a cause of action, whether it's common law property, I mean, common, community property, or and it also has a further effect of divesting a child of its legitimacy, because it's precluding any type of proof that a marriage existed or litigation of such a marriage.
Ms. Ricker, let me ask you a question. How do you respond to Justice Rickoff's concurring opinion in Ms. Stokes' argument, to this argument? Nancy, your client, shortly after Julio's death, signed a statement that they were boyfriend and girlfriend, had no plans to be married, and she signed and she filed income tax returns that she was single. She had student aid forms that she was single. And then after Julio's parents filed a claim for compensation under the Wrongful Death and Survival Actions, she then 2 years later comes and says, "I lied. I was married," and that this is the very thing that the legislature had in mind when they put a 1 year limitation to prove an informal marriage. And why isn't Justice Rickoff not correct in his statement, as a matter of law, your client is single?
In the case of Nancy Fuentes, there is some statement in the appellant's brief in a footnote that says that that Nancy had signed some kind of a statement which indicated that she was single with regard to trans-American, and I wish to bring forward that it is Nancy's position that that she was duped into signing that statement, that they approached her without the benefit of her having any counsel, any legal type of advice. She didn't even have an attorney hired at that time, and approached her saying, "You don't really want to sue us, do you?" And having her execute a statement that she wasn't going to assert any type of claim. I think that if you were to read the entire deposition testimony of Ms. Fuentes, I think you'd realize that she's probably, you've best described as naive, and she doesn't understand some of the things, and she sought to accommodate the request of her mother-in-law, Mrs. Thorpe, I believe, or Mrs. Fuentes.
How can she be a mother-in-law when she told that person, "I was never married to your son, we had no plans to be married, we're not husband and wife"?
Yes, the affidavit that Mrs. Silvis filed in the in her proceeding as a, I believe it's the administrator, that she and her husband filed, was that they had to state those things, and that Miss Fuentes, Nancy Fuentes, actually did it as merely an accommodation. She does say that in her testimony, I believe you'll find, that she did this as merely an accommodation, and that perhaps she didn't understand what was going on in the effect of her rights and how it would affect her common law marriage. I think also within the testimony you'll find that there's some kind of an argument made by Transamerican and the other defendants that they claim that she actually admitted in her testimony that she wasn't common law married. And then she comes back and later on says, "Well, yes, I am. At least we thought we were married, but perhaps she doesn't understand the legal elements of what a common law marriage was. But she and her husband both thought that they were common law married, held themselves out that way, and that the only really real reason that she tried to do this or hold herself out not as married is perhaps to protect her, I guess it's her education, right to have financial aid for her education.
She can't have it both ways. She's either single or married.
Admittedly so, but isn't this an issue for the trial court to decide whether there was or there wasn't a common law marriage?
Why is this a law question when you have when you have the statements that I've stated? What's there to dispute? She made the statement that we're not married, we're boyfriend, girlfriend. She filed aid as a single person. She filed income tax returns as a single person. What's a dispute? Where's the fact issue?
Well, the fact issue comes from statements that she says, well, we thought we were common law married, and she goes forward with the other things. Perhaps I'm not understanding your question, but the way I understood the testimony and the evidence in front of us was that that there were issues of fact, and that was recognized by the Court of Appeals, that there were issues of fact, and that those things should be allowed to be reviewed by the trial court.
I was asking you to respond to a concurring opinion that says that there are no fact issues.
Oh, to Judge Rickoff. I'm sorry. Well, it's our position that there are. I think that he's taking a restrictive view of it, and that, once again, that it should be allowed to go down, that there are fact issues and that this is an evidentiary question. And what's happening here is that Transamerica and the other petitioners are allowing or using 1.91B to preclude any type of a ruling on the issue of whether there existed a common law marriage. And as part of the wrongful death action, you'll have to establish that there's a common law marriage before you can proceed with the rest of it. So obviously, we're only asking for the day in court to establish that and then go forward if, in fact, she does have. Back to. In petitioner's brief, the petitioner has tried to have the cake and eat it too by coming around with an additional interpretation of 1.91B by saying that that 1.91B is only just to require a filing to establish the relationship, and then you have your additional two-year statute of limitations in which to bring any other action. And she cites the Danley case, Danley versus Almond, in which to support this claim. I respectfully submit that the Danley reasoning is misapplied, that it doesn't actually look at the situation at hand, because in this particular case, Danley only looked at the application of 1.91B to Section A2. It didn't look at the effect of it on Section A1. And when it was saying that the purpose of the statute, is the one-year statute of limitations, would be to allow the bringing of a claim while you had witnesses present and to avoid any type of staleness and things like that, what would be the effect of actually having a filed statement, a filed declaration, where the parties both admitted that there was one? And the effect of 1.91B is to preclude any proof of that statement or any admission of that declaration of informal marriage after a one-year period has gone by from the time that the relationship ended, either through death or through separation for agreement. And by doing this, by arguing that Section 1.91B is only for only requires just an action to establish the marriage, it actually is creating an ambiguity. And so what's happening is that they're arguing from both sides. Petitioners are arguing from both sides by saying that in the one hand, you have 1 year to bring any action, and in the converse, you have 1 year in which to establish your marriage, and then you have 2 years to go on and go further with your statement. And furthermore, when we look I think the real issue here, what we're looking at in this particular case, as it applies to or in the light of this court's ruling in Brown and in Gaza, we have a situation here where we have a wrongful death act, and we're looking at the Wrongful Death Act having an exception to it. And there is no basis for creating an exception to the Wrongful Death Act for common law marriage.
The statute's been changed, right, to 191?
Yes, sir. It has.
It now reads 2 years on the date on which the parties separated and ceased living together.
Yes, sir. And
would
also...
Would that mean when one of them dies, or does that contemplate something that happened while both were alive?
Actually, that's a good question. I've pondered it myself. I don't understand whether they contemplate it or not, but what I find interesting in the entire statement of the statute, if you'll stop and think about the new Section B, it only applies to A1. It doesn't apply necessarily to A2. It doesn't apply to A1. If you read the language of B now, it doesn't necessarily negate the inference of the declaration of marriage. Another thing that happens with it is that it's now a rebuttable presumption. It creates a rebuttal. It's not a statute of limitations like the operation that it was previously. And perhaps there's an opportunity in the future for that language that you're asking about to be interpreted in light of all of this.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council.
Justice Gordon, to address the question you'd asked earlier, could a common law spouse seek to be appointed administrator if the decedent died intestate within a year? And it's true, they could. Actually, in this case, respondent originally filed her suit not only individually but as administrator of the estate and then dropped that claim when the defendant filed a motion to dismiss saying she wasn't the administrator, that the father had already been appointed one. But she could have sought to attain that status.
If the spouse had filed a declaratory judgment action and won it, got a judgment that she was a common law spouse, could the wrongful death defendants contest that in the wrongful death case?
I don't think so, Your Honor, since I think the family code and the probate codes already countenance actions where family members and survivors can establish their status and then use that in other proceedings as evidence of their status without those defendants having been part of those proceedings.
So even though they weren't parties and would otherwise have the chance to litigate that issue in the wrongful death action, they would be bound by the declaratory judgment?
Well, I think that there's a good argument that they would be bound. I can't say definitively. Justice Gonzalez, in response to your question, I do believe that this is a situation where, as a matter of law, there isn't a common law marriage. I want to respond to respondent's point that she was duped. There's no evidence in the record that she was duped or misled. She testified that she did give the statement that she was doing it to help out Julio's mother, but that she knew she was giving a false statement and that it was false. And I think the intimation that she's naive isn't supported by the record, since she did know enough to deny her marital status on her student loan applications, and she said that's why they didn't get married formally any earlier. I'd like to conclude that I think the Court of Appeals is concerned that applying Section 1.91B to wrongful death claims would be unfair. I think that arguably it's not unfair considering the legislative interest. There's no concern in these cases that within a year of death, the alleged common law spouse will not have notice of the injury that provides the basis of her wrongful death claim. As this court recognized in Moreno, quote, survivors are put on immediate notice by the event of death and an investigation into the cause of action must occur to preserve the claim, end quote, and that they have definitive notice of the fact. Making up their cause of action. Indeed, in this case, respondent not only knew immediately of Julio Fuentes' death, but she also knew that the parents who filed their own wrongful death and survival claims, I believe the day after he died, and she admitted that she knew about this action. So she knew that there was a possible cause of action. Also, there's not a concern that at the time of death, common law spouses will not know that they have a potential common law marriage claim. The very nature of the claim includes facts with, securely within the common law spouse's knowledge. An agreement to be married and holding themselves out is the public as married. Respondent admitted that at the time she and Julia Fuentes lived together, that she thought they had a common law marriage and that she knew what a common law marriage was at that time. Finally, the trial court's holding in this case did not even deprive respondent of the right to bring her wrongful death claims against three of the five defendants in this case, since it is undisputed that she did not file suit against Continental EMSCO, Dana Corporation, or Wilson Wichita within even 2 years. The Court of Appeals is incorrect when it says that she filed suit within two against everyone. For all of these reasons, the Court of Appeals erred in refusing to give effect to the explicit statutory language of Section 1.91B with little analysis and a total disregard of the legitimate state policy served by the statute. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second clause, and the court will take another recess.